Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Carol DiBenedetto, a member of the club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum and your chair for this evening's program. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. It is now my pleasure to introduce Kenneth Cook, the president and co-founder of Environmental Working Group, who will talk to us tonight about 10 Americans, the inconvenient truth for environmental health. Besides co-founding the Environmental Working Group in 1993, Ken is the author of dozens of articles, opinion pieces, and reports on environmental, public health, and agricultural topics. Ken earned a Bachelor of Arts, Bachelor of Science, and a Master of Science degrees from University of Missouri Columbia, and he's traveled from his home in Washington, D.C. to join us here tonight. Ken will share with us the updated results of Environmental Working Group's landmark 10 Americans study, which finds 287 toxins linked to cancer and other serious health problems. Ken will also talk about Environmental Working Group's not-yet-released report on school cleaners and our children's health, focusing on local Bay Area school districts. So please get your questions ready for Ken about what you can do to protect yourself and your loved ones. It is now my pleasure to turn the floor over to David. Oh, sorry. Did I say David? Ken.
Carol, thank you very much. It's a thrill to be here at the Commonwealth Club, such a prestigious setting and such a great audience. So thank you for joining us this evening. A few weeks ago, you may have had the opportunity to hear the EPA Administrator, Lisa P. Jackson, give a landmark speech to the Commonwealth Club. And, of course, this made waves all over the country because for the first time in a generation, the Administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, with the full support of the Obama administration, announced that they were supporting a complete overhaul of the federal law that governs toxic industrial chemicals. It was a great day for those of us who have been working very hard for many years to launch a campaign to do just that. And in this talk, you'll see exactly why it is we need to do it. But in the course of her remarks, she referenced the 10 Americans I'm going to be talking about tonight, 10 people whose unique background and history have caused them to really be the inspiration, in many respects, for a revolution, an upsurge of support to deal with toxic chemicals and the impacts they're having on our health, starting with the health, of course, of the most vulnerable among us, which is our children. The 10 Americans I'm talking about tonight are very unusual because one day in 2004, we took a sample of blood from each and every one of them and sent it to laboratories where it was tested for 413 toxic industrial chemicals and pesticides. No group of people in history has ever been tested for this many chemicals. We've been testing for pollutants in air and water and land for decades, but only recently have we discovered and studied the pollution in people. And that's what we did in this Environmental Working Group study of these 10 Americans. And we found, across just those 10 people, 287 of the 413 chemicals we were looking for, an average of about 200 each. We found 28 different waste byproducts in their blood, dioxins, furans, chemicals that come out of smokestacks and incinerators, 47 different consumer product ingredients, Teflon chemicals, flame retardants like the ones in that projector probably. And most surprising of all, in just these 10 people, we found 212 industrial chemicals and pesticides that had been banned 30 years before we took their blood samples and showed up in 2004 in our laboratory study. They might have been exposed by virtue of the air that they breathe. We found some air pollutants in there. We know from EPA studies that some 600 million pounds of air pollutants, 650 different types, were emitted into the air in 2004. But even though we found some of those chemicals in these 10 Americans, we know for a fact that they weren't exposed by virtue of the air that they breathed. It could have been the water that they drank out of a bottle or from the tap, and believe it or not, some tap water does begin, before it's treated, looking something like this. Our online studies, our database that we've created, the National Tap Water Database, came up with about 1,000 different contaminants in finished drinking water in cities all over the United States. But we know for a fact that none of these 10 Americans were exposed by virtue of the water that they drank, even though we found some of these pollutants in them. Could have been, but it wasn't, things that contaminate food. For example, the more than 1,000 food additives that the Food and Drug Administration regulates because they're components of packaging used for food that migrates from the packaging and into the food. We found some of these chemicals in these 10 Americans, but we know for a fact that it had nothing to do with what they ate, either at home or in a restaurant. That's not how they came to be contaminated. Personal care products. We'll talk about this in a little bit more detail later. Women use an average of about 12 per day, according to our online survey. That exposes them to over 160 different consumer product ingredients, different chemicals. Men use about half that many, about six, and that exposes them to 85. Our survey did show, however, that most men use both toothpaste and deodorant. So this is not just a gloom and doom talk tonight. There's a bright side to some of what I have to say. But we know for a fact that none of the consumer product ingredients that they brought home from the drugstore, purchased at the grocery store, used to wash their hair, makeup, deodorant, shaving cream, none of those were the source of the contaminants that we found in their bodies. See, there's proof. Here's a gentleman brushing his teeth right there. They didn't work in a place like this. It wasn't industrial exposure, even though we found all kinds of industrial toxins in them. They weren't farmers or farm workers. That's not how they came by the pesticides we found in their blood. So 287 chemicals in just 10 people from one sample in one day. Who were they? How were they exposed? Well, the truth of the matter is we don't really know very much about them. About the only thing we know for certain is that when the exposures took place, they looked something like this. This is an image of a baby late in his development in the womb. We tested umbilical cord blood for those toxic chemicals, and what we found in there was what the mother was exposed to, the things she ate, the air she breathed, the water she drank. For many years, medical doctors, scientists felt that the placenta filtered out a lot of toxic chemicals, but it turned out our study showed that that was not the case. They were getting through, hundreds of them. We also know that babies at this stage in life are getting about 30 quarts of blood circulating to them a day from the mother, carrying not just those contaminants, but of course the oxygen that allows the baby to live in the womb, the nutrition that's causing the baby to grow so rapidly, nervous system developing, other organ systems developing, the miracle of life itself. And it all depends on the blood that's pulsing back and forth through that umbilical cord. We know that babies at this stage in life do not have a blood-brain barrier to shield their developing brain tissue from toxins. They'll have that barrier in just a few months, and it will develop more progressively in their first year of life, but right now they don't have it. And the other thing we know is that about this particular baby is this is my baby. This is Callahan Cook, who was born on June 6th of last year, 2008. He's a very happy and healthy 16-month-old. And I just want to tell all of you in the audience and all of you who may be listening that even though we're starting off with a fairly heavy message here, which is that industrial pollution begins in the womb, it turns out okay if you face up to the fact that we have a problem that needs solving. And tonight I'm going to talk to you about how we need to solve it. And there he is just a little while ago, happy, healthy, getting into everything he can possibly get into. But like all babies, he started with this burden of industrial pollution. Now, these weren't just any chemicals. When we analyzed them against our toxicity databases at the Environmental Working Group, we found that 134 of the chemicals, 134 of that 287, were shown to have caused cancer in either laboratory studies or in studies of people. 151 were linked to birth defects. 154 were hormone disruptors. 186 linked in animal or human studies to infertility. Now, you're doing a little math now, maybe, and coming to understand that there are more effects than there are chemicals. Well, the reason is that many of these chemicals have multiple adverse health effects. Carcinogens can be reproductive toxins. Immune system toxins can also cause damage to the developing nervous system, and on and on. Immune system toxicity, 130 different chemicals. Neurotoxins, lead, PCBs, mercury, other industrial chemicals, 158 in all. We never study these chemicals in these combinations. This load that we're all carrying of multiple chemicals is never evaluated by scientists, much less by regulators, to see what the combined load might mean. But the reality is that that load is there. And not long ago, friends of ours wrote in a peer-reviewed journal with respect to neurotoxins, this sentence: the combined evidence suggests that neurodevelopmental disorders caused by industrial chemicals have created a silent pandemic in modern society of neurological disorders and diseases. A silent pandemic. So what does the chemical industry say? Well, they say a couple of things. They say the doses are too low to matter, and even if they weren't too low to matter, the chemicals themselves are not necessarily harmful to people. And you know what? They're right. Just because you can find a toxic chemical does not mean that it's causing harm, and sometimes very low doses do not matter. And we're talking about parts per billion. And the industry likes to point out, this is their metaphor, that a part per billion is the equivalent of one pancake in a stack of pancakes 4,000 miles high. This is an actual photograph of the stack of pancakes the industry produced to make this point. They have a lot more money than we have, but we have a very cool slideshow. So are the doses really too low to matter in the part per billion range? Well, if it's toxic chemicals and the bizarre, unfamiliar names many of them have, it might not be obvious that low doses in the parts per billion range can really make much of a difference. But let me suggest that if we think about it in terms of some other chemicals we're more familiar with, you'll begin to get the idea that low doses can matter, and you shouldn't let anyone tell you otherwise until they can prove that they've tested the chemicals for safety and shown them to be safe at low doses. The chemicals I'm talking about are pharmaceuticals, drugs. Albuterol is in the desk drawer of every school nurse and every teacher, likely, in the United States now. It is active in the blood, even though it's topically active as a drug. But in the blood, after one dose, you have 2.1 parts per billion, and it has almost 100% effectiveness stopping an initial asthma attack, at least when it's initially used. 2.1 parts per billion. Paxil, common antidepressant, is active therapeutically with one dose at 30 parts per billion in the blood. Cialis, which can have profound therapeutic effects, is active in the blood with one dose and it lasts for 36 hours, or is it 48 hours? Anyone know? That's a trick question, gentlemen. Don't answer. 30 parts per billion. Or how about NuvaRing? Active, this is one of the most commonly prescribed birth control drugs in the country now, NuvaRing. Active, almost 100% effective at 0.035 parts per billion, less than 0.04 of a pancake in a stack of pancakes 4,000 miles high. But it turns out that we're not all the same. So even though you can have profound therapeutic effects from a drug when it is used as directed, some people experience side effects from drugs at those same very low doses. So let's go back to Cialis, for instance. Again, 30 parts per billion in your blood in case a playful moment turns into the right moment. But some people experience the following side effect. If you have any sudden decrease in hearing or vision, if you can't see or hear at 30 parts per billion, stop taking Cialis and seek immediate medical help. Now, we're all adults here, so I'm not afraid to tell you about the next side effect because you've all seen it, as most 10-year-olds have seen if they've watched television. At 30 parts per billion, if you experience an erection lasting more than 4 hours, call your doctor right away. I'm intensely interested in these calls. I want to know how they go. Does the doctor say, "Well, sir, you know, that would only really be 30 pancakes in a stack 4,000 miles high"? Or maybe you can't get to the phone right away. Maybe your wife or your partner has been tying up the phone with calls to 911, seeking emergency assistance. Maybe a SWAT team is on the way. Low doses can matter. 30 parts per billion or lower can matter. Industrial chemicals at this concentration can reduce head circumference and birth weight at birth. Doses at this level and well below it can interrupt the thyroid functioning. They can disrupt other hormone systems. We are just beginning to understand what these low doses of many chemicals can mean for us. But the difference between drugs and the industrial chemicals I'm talking about tonight are drugs are tested very rigorously. Now, we still find mistakes that are made. We read about them in the newspaper every day. Someone's using a drug as directed, and lo and behold, they have a side effect much worse than this one, and as a consequence, they become very ill or perhaps die, and that's after we've done extensive testing, including clinical trials. Well, we don't do anything approaching that for industrial chemicals that are also in all of us, and they're in us, for the most part, without our consent. Low doses matter. Let me just review. For 30 parts per billion, we can inspire human reproduction with Cialis. For another 0.035 parts per billion, we can prevent it altogether. And for another 30 parts per billion of Paxil, you can chill out either way. So why are we concerned about these chemicals, these multiple chemicals to which we're exposed? The answer is that there are changes in the health status of our population, changes in disease and illness rates that we cannot explain by genetics alone. We're not evolving so quickly that increases in cancer and other diseases, which I'm about to tell you about, is a result of our evolution. In fact, what is happening, scientists now believe, is not a distinction between nature and nurture, but the combination of the two, the intersection of what you bring to the party genetically with some exposure that might turn a gene off or on, the epigenetic effects that scientists are racing to understand now, that might in fact lead to a very harmless and temporary change in your body's function or no change at all, or might be the beginning of a long-term illness. And one such disease is acute lymphocytic leukemia. 84% increase in children between 1975 and 2002. Hypospadias, a birth defect that affects baby boys, doubled. Now one in 125 baby boys that require surgery to fix, because this is a birth defect where the urethra comes out not at the tip of the penis, but somewhere else along the shaft, and it must be fixed immediately when the baby is born and this is discovered. Now one in every 125 baby boys, approaching 1%. Chemicals are implicated. How about childhood brain cancer? It has increased by 57% between 1975 and 2002. This is an illness, if you speak to a pediatrician practicing in the 1970s, they will tell you they didn't miss childhood brain cancer as a diagnosis back then. If a kid has brain cancer, you know it. This disease is on the rise because this disease is on the rise. It's not a matter of better diagnosis or detection. Then there's the great scourge, the great tragedy, the great mystery of autism. One in 150 out of 150 children in this country is somewhere along the spectrum of the autism diseases. One in 150, and in some states where we have better data, it is approaching 1%. No one knows what's going on, but everyone is concerned that there, again, is a combination, since 60% of children with autism are boys, some combination between their genetic endowment and some chemical exposure that might be triggering the onset of this terrible health problem. Breast development by race. This is an interesting, fairly recent study. What's going on here? White girls, in the late 1940s, the onset of breast development was close to the age of 11. Now it has dropped down to below the age of 10. That's the average that noted in pediatrician visits where young girls present breasts in the examination. For black girls, it's even more shocking. We have fewer data points, but we see that black girls from the early 1970s through fairly recently, the average onset age of breast development is below the age of 9. Is it the food they're eating? Is it something in the food? Is it some other important behavioral pattern? We don't know. But the change is real, and it's profound. Asthma in children. I'll be talking about asthmogens in just a moment with respect to our forthcoming study of school cleaners. When I was growing up, I didn't know anybody with asthma. That was a while ago. But now, it's 1 in 10 children in this country who has asthma. What is going on? But it's not just kids. What about adults? About 7.3 million American couples have trouble becoming pregnant or carrying a baby to full term now. It's a 20% increase in just the past decade. And the group that is having the problem growing the most quickly is women of childbearing age under the age of 25. In men, we see decreased sperm count by about 1% per year in the United States and in Northern Europe. Breast cancer, 1 woman in 8 across the whole population. Does anyone here not know someone, not know a family, not know a friend whose lives have been touched by this disease? Probably not. And 1 in 3 women, half of all men, will develop cancer sometime during their life. And we know from migration studies that that's not the case everywhere. We have the highest rate of cancer incidence anywhere in the world where the data are reliable. And when people migrate from Japan, for example, to the United States, within a generation, their rates of cancer skyrocket, approaching ours. In this study, a 4-fold increase in prostate cancer and a 2.4-fold increase in breast cancer for Japanese immigrants into the United States within a generation. So what's going on? And what can you do? Well, we can't avoid all these exposures. Let me make that point one more time for the radio audience. You can't avoid exposures. You can't live under a rock. You can't check out of the modern world. And no one's proposing that we do that. We want to try and prevent these exposures, even as we try and understand which exposures are the most serious and how we can deal with them, and of course, how we treat some of the diseases and health problems that they might be causing. Well, one thing you can do is you can shop smarter, and we have lots of tips on our website at ewg.org for what to do. Buy organic food, knock down the pesticides and artificial hormones and other contaminants that are inorganic, that are not inorganic or in conventional food. Eat fish that's low in mercury. We have a list of those fish on our website. It's pretty easy to avoid them and still get all the benefits that come from eating fish. Filter your tap water. We recommend using stainless instead of nonstick because of all the fumes and particles that come off of overheated nonstick pans. And shop smarter for personal care products, the perfumes and cosmetics that we all use. For example, let's look at personal care products. About 90% of the products we have looked at and the chemicals we have looked at when we analyzed personal care products have not been fully assessed for safety. As I mentioned before, women use about 12 personal care products a day. Men use about 6. This is from our online survey of thousands of people. And in our Skin Deep database online, which we recommend you consult, we have about 51,000 plus products listed with all of their ingredients. It's the only place you can look to see what ingredients are in your personal care products and what those ingredients might mean for your health. We've linked thousands of those ingredients to over 50 toxicity databases that enables us to evaluate. Are they carcinogens? How strongly carcinogenic? Are they mutagens? Well, how powerfully are they mutagenic? And so forth. And it gets about 5 million searches a month. But the problem is, of course, that these exposures are ongoing. 168 unique chemicals on average for women, 85 for men. And no one knows what the combined effects of just that one set of consumer product ingredients used on the largest organ in your body, your skin, what effect that might be having. So what do you do? Use fewer products, we recommend. Don't use so many. Cut out the nail polish if you can. Cut out the dark hair dye. Those are the ones that consistently show up having toxic components in our reviews. And, of course, go to our Skin Deep database. Bring your computer or to your cabinet in your bathroom, or bring your bathroom cabinet to your computer, whatever is more convenient, and start looking up your products and see what's in them. And you'll be amazed at just how many chemicals either we don't have good data on, or where we do have a peer-reviewed study, a government study, there's a concern. Now, tomorrow we're going to be releasing a study about another source of contamination that affects all of us. I don't ever give this talk that I'm not asked about the stuff under the sink, the cleaners, the products that we use to scrub the bathroom sink, what we use on our floors, our walls, our countertops, and on and on. Our first step at EWG to try and understand what the exposures might be there was focused on a specific population of schools, school children. We looked at cleaners used in schools, specifically in 13 different school districts, big ones, right here in California. Bakersfield, Fairfield, Sassoon, Fresno, Daly City, which is the Jefferson School District, Los Angeles, Oakland, Sacramento City, San Bernardino City, San Francisco, San Jose, Stockton, Visalia, and West Contra Costa County, in all of those school districts. And we examined, in fact, our scientist is here tonight who did the lead on the work, Dr. Becky Sutton. We looked at 21 different school cleaners And we found 450 different chemicals in there when we put those cleaners to the test in an air chamber, used them as directed, pulled the air out of the chamber afterwards, sent it to a chemical analyzer, and said, what is in those cleaners? And the answer, 450 plus cleaners in those school districts. When we release the results tomorrow, they'll be released in Southern California, but there'll be press activity all over the state. What we expect will happen will be a great deal of concern by parents and a desire to try and do something. And, you know, this is something where we can do something. Our study showed that the certified green cleaners that we examined were safer. There were still some chemicals in them, but much less chemical exposure in the air when they're used than conventional cleaners. And it also brought home the obvious need to help schools clean in a green fashion. This is something any parent can do who's engaged in their child's education. Go to the school, make the case for greener cleaners. Go to our website tomorrow for a start on what those might be, and demand that we keep getting better and better at keeping these toxins away from our kids, because at least six of them were asthmogens, a number of them were hormone disruptors, a number of them were carcinogens, and they're coming off in the air in our classrooms, our school hallways, our cafeterias, our gymnasiums, all over the country. So the personal care products add some, the school cleaners add some, the cleaning at home adds some, on and on. But it's also important tonight to recognize that we don't recommend that America try and shop its way out of this problem. I know that when my wife and I were expecting our little guy, we found ourselves resenting having to go to website after website to find out what was safe to buy, to make sure that he was protected as best he could be protected from toxic chemicals. And I was resenting websites that were my websites. We're too busy to have to think through every single purchase and do research on each and every one of them. We need the government to do its job, and it hasn't been doing its job. The reason chemicals are showing up in the umbilical cord blood of babies is the same reason that they're showing up on the front page of newspapers all over the country. It's the Toxic Substances Control Act of 1976. Past 30 years ago, it has never been updated and modernized. Think of all we've learned about toxic chemicals and their effects on our health and the environment in the past generation. This law is the only major environmental law that has never been reauthorized, modernized, to meet what we now know as the scientific basis for public health and toxic chemicals. At the time it was passed in 1976 and signed into law by President Ford, may he rest in peace, 62,000 chemicals were grandfathered in and presumed safe by the law. 62,000. The law did not require any health or safety studies for new chemicals introduced into the market. And the idea was the government would go back and look over the first 62,000, now we're up to about 80,000, to see if they were safe. Well, what happened? Well, 80% of new chemicals that come into the Environmental Protection Agency for approval, 80% are approved within 3 weeks. It takes longer to get a driver's license in some places. And in the entire history of the Toxic Substances Control Act, or TSCA as it's known in environmental circles, only five chemicals have been banned or restricted by EPA under the law. This is a point that Administrator Jackson made a month ago here at the Commonwealth Club as she was pointing out the need to protect babies in the womb from the 287 chemicals that she referenced from our study in her remarks. The answer is we need to rewrite this decrepit, fossilized, broken law. We need to bring this law into the modern era. And we think the way to do it, and there's a campaign growing all around the country, is to pass in its place, to replace it with, the KidSafe Chemicals Act. here's what the KidSafe Chemicals Act would do in general. It would require that chemicals be safe for children and others who are sensitive before they're allowed on the market. What a concept. It would assume that chemicals are harming people until proven otherwise. It would reverse the burden of proof. Right now, EPA, with extremely limited regulatory authority, has to prove harm. Well, why should that be the case? The companies that are making these chemicals and making money selling them ought to prove they're safe before they come onto the market. This law would reverse the burden of proof, which is another reason why we need to pass it. It prioritizes the review of these tens of thousands of chemicals that we're all exposed to that are in commerce now based on what's in people. If a chemical is contaminating us, and we know that from biomonitoring studies like the one we did of cord blood, that ought to put those chemicals on a list for speedy review. And the speediest review of all, and this is why we're so proud that the 10 Americans have contributed not just to Administrator Jackson's thinking on this matter, but to public policy ideas, is this. If chemicals are found in umbilical cord blood, they ought to be presumed unsafe, to not meet a safety standard under this act. And unless they can be shown on an expedited basis to be safe, they'd have to be limited in their use or phased out altogether. This legislation was championed first in 2005 by some of the greatest leaders in the environmental realm in the U.S. Congress, Senator Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey, Congressman Henry Waxman of California, Senator Barbara Boxer of California, then Senator Jim Jeffords of Vermont, and many, many more. And it's about to be reintroduced in this Congress, and we're hoping, with the strong support that we're hearing for toxics reform from Lisa Jackson, we'll be seeing this law a reality in the near term. And this is where you can find out about it, www.ewg/kidsafe, or just go to ewg.org. And I just want to close by telling you, we can make this happen. We can do this. We have changed public perceptions about health risks. We changed it on smoking. We were in a period where doctors were appearing in magazine advertisements talking about their favorite brand of cigarette. That has all changed. We've cleaned up air. Not enough, but a great deal. We've cleaned up water. We've cleaned up entire industries. And even though we have a long way to go, tonight I want to remind everyone about something you may not have thought about. We've actually also already managed to clean up our blood when we put our minds to it. For example, we took the lead out of gasoline, and blood lead levels in the U.S. population plummeted. We still have a problem with lead, particularly exposure in older homes, particularly in older communities and low-income communities. It's still a problem with lead toxicity in children, but we've made great strides. PCB in blood. This was a chemical that we found in these babies in 2004. Still around. We banned it in 1976. It was a chemical that was used in electrical equipment to help insulate it, to keep it from overheating. It was said at the time, if we banned it, we might not have an electrical grid. Well, the lights are still on. We did ban it in 1976, and PCB levels in blood, likewise, have plummeted in our population. And then there's DDT, once used 60% of it in this country for cotton, but it was said at the time if we banned it, we wouldn't be able to eat. Well, we are still eating, we're still producing lots of crops without DDT, and blood lead levels of DDT have gone down. But like PCBs, when we tested those babies in 2004, tested their umbilical cord blood, we found DDT too. And the lesson is very clear. If something's toxic, lasts a long time, and contaminates people, don't waste a minute taking action to move to something safer and quickly. My son, when I think about him and I think of the images I have on my iPhone, the images I have in my computer, If you'd like to see the images, we could spend about 4 or 5 hours just looking through them tonight. But I think of one image in particular about 2 weeks after he was born. We're on the front porch of our house. And he is experiencing, not really seeing, but experiencing his first thunderstorm rolling in across the distance. And I look into those big eyes of his and that little mouth circled in an O. And what I see in that face is every hope for his future, every possible curiosity about his world, every possible joy, every possible opportunity to live to his full potential without being burdened by the impact of toxic chemicals that I know he was exposed to for all our best efforts, even when he was in the womb. We need a thunderstorm to roll into Washington, D.C., and make sure that Congress knows we have to do better. We can do better. We can pass the KidSafe Chemicals Act, and in doing so, make sure that future generations are protected from the toxic chemicals that today contaminate them even before they enter the world. Thank you very much.
Audience, that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Kenneth Cook, president and co-founder of Environmental Working Group, speaking to us about 10 Americans, the inconvenient truth for environmental health. So if you would like to line up for questions, there's two mics here for you to come ask Ken your questions.
Yes, sir.
Why not create an iPhone app or one that works on all phones and whatnot that would scan the UPS barcode by which you know what the product is, and you yourselves from your database know what all the chemicals are and what they affect? And I wonder if that wouldn't have an effect on shoppers.
I think you're exactly right. There is technology out there. In fact, there is an iPhone app that will scan universal barcodes and tell you what product it is, and that would be the next step would be to link it to a database. We'd love to do that. Our next big project to create a database is to try and do for food what we've done for personal care products, collect the ingredient information and be able to give people for packaged food, which is a surprisingly large portion of what we all spend our money on, however much we may try and eat fresh produce. We want to try and build that database, and we're trying to assemble the resources to do that right now. And this would be exactly the kind of application we would try and put together so that people in real time can go out and understand what their choices are. And we have the information technology in place now to be able to do that. And I think more and more people are tuning in when they shop to try and buy healthier, safer alternatives. There's no question about that. That market is exploding. We combine that consumer pressure, that consumer interest, with some good old-fashioned citizenship so that when you think about your safety and your family's safety, you don't just worry about what you are shopping for, but you worry about who you're voting for, and you let them know why you're voting for them. And one reason is you want to make sure that toxic chemicals are more strongly regulated. And I think the combination of the technology and the call to action, not just as shoppers, but as citizens, is critical to making a big difference in this field. Yes, ma'am. I'll go to this microphone. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I'm a nurse and a clinical researcher, and I have a two-part question.
Yes. Could you speak up just a little bit, maybe?
Yeah. My first question is, are there any studies planned regarding the chemical soup now that we are all walking around with and what those results may be?
It's very difficult to study these combinations of chemicals. By the time you pick just a few chemicals and the combinations of dose levels that you would be interested in studying, you get a bewildering number of possible combinations, and it becomes very difficult to disentangle a health effect that you might observe in a study from exactly which combination of chemicals you're trying. That's why this is such a tragedy, because as you suggest, we are living in a world of a chemical soup. Low dose and high dose exposures, multiple chemicals, all of us are different. We might have right now in us, in this fairly small group here, thousands and thousands of chemicals. We spent $10,000 on that cord blood study per sample for the lab work. If we had spent $15,000 or $20,000, we may have found not 287 chemicals, but 500 or 600 or 800. Who knows how many we'd find, because no one's bothered to look. So even though we were very proud of that study and the impact that it has had, we recognize that we're probably never going to be in a position to fully understand the health implications of multiple chemical exposures. We know the exposures are real, and we have every reason to believe that in many cases the effects may be additive. Neurotoxin on neurotoxin on neurotoxin might finally trigger a reaction that just a few neurotoxins didn't. Maybe the same with carcinogens. And in some areas of law, environmental law, these are regulated together, pesticide law, for example. But we just don't know. So our advice has been, and our policy prescription has been, since we aren't going to know that about chemical combinations, the chemical soup, we ought to start reducing the exposures for the chemicals that we know, at least alone, if not in simple combinations, are causing some problems. And that's the direction where research is going now. Maybe over time, with more sophisticated methods, being able to analyze the effects of chemicals, turning genes off and on, epigenetic studies, we may, over time, be able to more efficiently study common combinations. We all have PCBs in us here. We all have the Teflon chemical in us here. We all have the Scotchgard chemical in us here. We have that in common with probably every marine mammal on the Earth. The entire biosphere is contaminated. But when we know these simple combinations are existing and they're prevalent, there's some reason to believe that if we conducted some fairly modest testing of those combinations, we might gain some insights as to what the health effects may be.
Can I ask my second
question? Yes, you have a second question? Sure.
So I worked in a medical device company for a long time, and the FDA makes those companies spend tons and tons of money and go through lots of hoops and clinical trials to get their product on the market. So I really just don't even understand what is going on and why we are in this situation.
Why chemical companies and others don't have to do any testing. Well, it's an artifact of this old law, the 1976 law, and at the time it was written, I think there were some good intentions that it would, in effect, help protect us from some of these chemicals, but there's no one who really thinks it's a good idea. It's working adequately now. In fact, I should have mentioned earlier, and I'll mention now, most of the major chemical companies and their trade associations have also come out, as Administrator Jackson pointed out in her speech, and said, we need change. We held a national conference. The Environmental Working Group convened a national conference, and in a fairly unusual step for us, we invited, even though we paid for the conference, we invited the chemical industry to be co-sponsors, and they agreed. And we had a very rigorous debate, which you can see online at our website. We may not agree in every detail. In fact, we certainly don't agree in important respects. But they think we need to be protecting kids now. They think we need to overhaul this law now. They think we need a safety standard now. That is worlds different than what they were saying as an industry just a year and a half ago. So we're on the verge of one of the most important environmental campaigns in history. It's right on the launching pad now, and I'm delighted that all of you here are going to be participating in that with us. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. First of all, just thank you for the work you're doing. My body gets sick immediately when exposed to petrochemicals, so I know on a daily basis how toxic our world is. I have two very specific questions for you. One is in regard to industrial cleaning supplies. I mean, I know how to find what's safe for my own home, but when I speak to an institution about the state of their bathrooms, for instance, they say, well, you know, we have to get this from the supplier and da-da-da. And, of course, I don't know the names of any of those products. Will you be providing that sort of information on that level?
For the 21 school cleaners that we tested, we are going to be providing the names tomorrow. They are probably fairly commonly used in institutional settings, but I couldn't tell you just which institutions do use them. Right. We know that they're used in schools in California, and that would be a fairly common market for these kinds of supplies. It's very difficult to determine what is in these chemicals. Unlike personal care products, there's no requirement that the cleaners that you have under your sink of various types, for example, there's no requirement that they list all of their ingredients. There is legislation pending in Washington, and there have been some efforts at various states to try and require that rudimentary right to know for consumers. And we deserve to know what's in these products that we're using that are marketed aggressively and emotionally to keep us clean, keep us safe, keep us sparkling. Well, it would be nice to know if they're also making us sick. And right now, we can't tell that.
So what you find on the 21 schools will be on your website.
Oh, yes, ma'am. All of that detail will be made available tomorrow. In fact, it will be made available, I believe, at 9 p.m. Pacific time tonight. Is that correct, Dr. Sutton? I'm looking in the audience here, and a head is nodding from a person who actually knows because she did the research, was the lead researcher.
And my second question may be on something that you don't cover, but you may be able to give me some avenues to learn about it. I have found that printer's ink, soy-based printer's ink, my body lets me know very clearly that is far more toxic than ordinary printer's ink. And I understand the reason is that soy doesn't work as an ink, so they use all kinds of very lethal extenders so that they can get it to print. Do you have any information on that? Because when you go to printers, they say, oh, this is wonderful ink. It's very safe. That's why we're using it. And it's not.
I wish I could say I had information on soy-based inks and their use. I don't, but let me suggest we extract a common lesson from that, which is when chemicals are not regulated, even though they may sound like they're safe, sound like they come from natural sources, until they've really been shown to be safe, it's really not reasonable to expect that people should believe it. But thank you for your question. I wish I had more specific information.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
I work for the California State Legislature, and for 3 years, with your help, the Environmental Working Group has supported and sponsored the bill to ban bisphenol A from children's products for children under 3 years old. We tried it with everybody, and that didn't pass. We cannot get it to the governor's desk because the chemical industry here in California is so strong. So I'm really here to let everybody in this room know, because you're all Californians, obviously, that we're trying really hard here in California. And I think it's wonderful that you guys are introducing at the national level, but we have to get behind the California law and get this passed this year. This is our last chance, really, to get it out of the Assembly and the Senate and onto the governor's desk and to convince him to sign this piece of legislation and be on the cutting edge instead of having these other states starting to do this. And again, the people that you have working for you here in California have done just a fabulous job, but it's not enough. We need everybody in this room to start writing letters to get this terrible toxic out of these kids' products. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you for mentioning that. We're very proud of the work we've been doing on bisphenol A in California. It's been a tough fight. We've had a lot of help from groups like the Breast Cancer Fund.
Yes.
Have worked long and hard to get this law passed. We're up against a big and very powerful and wealthy industry that's not afraid to spend money and really is organized around maintaining the regulatory status quo, which is self-regulation. But Senator Fran Pavley, who led this fight, has done a spectacular job of taking this issue directly to her fellow legislators.
And we're bringing it back.
Yes, and it's coming back next year. So
we need everybody's help.
And if you want to find out about it, we'll let you know at EWG.org. Right. That's a fight that we want to win, and we have every reason to believe that if we do win it, California kids will be a lot safer.
Thank you very much.
For your comments. Yes, sir.
Hey, thanks. Thanks so much for all your work.
Our pleasure.
My question specifically about tap water, which you addressed a little bit today, but not as much specifically, that it seems like the KidSafe initiative is focusing around prevention of these chemicals into products and into our bodies in the first place, but for things like antibiotics, hormones, et cetera, they're pharmaceuticals. They're still going to be in tap water. And so I'm wondering, regardless of whether this act passes, what we can do to prevent those chemicals from contaminating the water supply, and also what you found are the technological limitations to removing them, if any, which I haven't heard that much about. Mostly I've heard that, right now the traditional water treatment process doesn't filter them out, but we don't know if they can be filtered out, first of all of them, and if so, how much would it cost, and what kind of implications would it have for government? So.
Well, thank you. That's another excellent question. They all have been. This is a big problem. Government surveys and some work by the Associated Press, among others, have found that in Finnish drinking water, we have all kinds of pharmaceutical products, hormones. We tested tap water in Washington, D.C., and found Tylenol. Just for starters, and I still gave me a headache finding it. So who knew? This is a very tough one. It is unthinkable that we could replumb our cities and our drinking water treatment to deal with the full range of contaminants, including those. I mean, most water systems, there's no way you could economically afford to get it out. I'm not even sure which filtration systems in the home, and we have an elaborate one in our home, really knock down those levels of those chemicals, even if you use something like reverse osmosis. I think part of the problem is going to be in the engineering of the pharmaceuticals, of the drugs themselves, so that when they're utilized, they are more effectively absorbed into the body, and there's less waste that finds its way into the water system. I think there have been proposals to collect unused medications, another source, if they're thrown out, that can cause contamination of drinking water supplies down the road. But really, it's all a lesson in just how important it is for us to take care of the environment that finds its way to all of us one way or the other, whether it's the tuna fish that you eat that is caught in the middle of the ocean and is contaminated with mercury from power plants in China or the United States, or the tap water that you drink that is contaminated by someone hundreds of miles away who flushed their toilet, and when they did that, they exposed you to, unwittingly, unknowingly, to a dose of toxic chemicals that couldn't be removed in a water filtration system. This is a big, big problem, and I think we've really just begun to scratch the surface of defining it. And I don't think we're very close at all to solving it. But this is an issue that we plan to be working on in the months ahead. We'll be updating our national tap water database in December, we expect. We're working with a major media organization to do that. So stay tuned. And this is an issue, along with bottled water, which is a whole different set of problems, but obviously related. We need to take both of them on. So thank you for your question. Yes, ma'am.
Hi.
Hi.
First of all, I have a four-year-old who's asthmatic, and so thank you so much for all of your work, as I'm trying to make him healthier. My question is about organic foods and produce.
Yes.
Is organic still as, I don't know, foolproof as it was a couple of years ago, now that Costco and all these other, you know, huge chains are claiming organic, but their produce is from Argentina? You know, I don't know how they get it here without it being sprayed, or so. I just wondering if it's apples to apples still.
Well, our sense is that with respect to pesticides, from the studies we have seen, organic food is still dramatically lower in pesticides, even though there are some pesticides in some organic foods that can't be avoided because they're in the soil. DDT is a good example. That is sometimes found in organic produce and sometimes in other products because the farmer literally can't do anything about it. If cotton was grown on that field a generation ago, there's enough DDT in there to still, breakdown products to still contaminate the food. Our feeling is that organic is still a very smart investment to make, smart value to avoid with respect to fruits and vegetables, pesticides. And when you talk about animal products, avoiding growth hormones, antibiotics, and so forth, it's a good way to avoid some of those problems too. And then there are some nutritional benefits for organic. But I also have to tell you, I'm on the board of the Organic Center, which is sort of the think tank, one of the think tanks for the organic industry, and we're very concerned about the need to more rigorously monitor the food supply, not just the organic, but even the conventional food supply. We don't do a very good job. Not much testing is done for pesticides on conventional food, for instance, and by the time the test results come in, we've eaten the food. It's that long of a lag time. So we don't exactly have a watchdog on the job, more of a lapdog. And so what we need to do is significantly increase our vigilance there. But if you're asking me, for my 16-month-old, I buy organic produce whenever I can. Sometimes you can't find it. Sometimes you can't afford it. I have a friend, Phil Landrigan, who refers to organic as private school for food. And I think he's right about that. But it to us, if you look at the exposures that you have from eating organic food versus conventional, it's dramatically lower in terms of pesticides. And if you go to our website, you can find at, in fact, we may have put this out for the audience here, but for those listening, the foodnews.org website can give you a handy card so that if you are shopping and you can't find or can't afford to buy all organic, a list of 15 fruits and vegetables that, even though they're grown conventionally, happen to be low in pesticides in the food itself. There may have been all kinds of risks that the farmers and farm workers experienced in producing it, but USDA and FDA studies have shown that the pesticide levels are pretty low. So we feel it's still a good deal. This is a global market now for organic. It's going to always be a global market. In fact, it's going to become more so. We have a fraction of the U.S. landscape, the farm landscape, that is farmed organically. It's less than 1%, even though there's been tremendous growth in the sales of organic. It's still a tiny industry. We need to grow it, and the way to grow it is to buy those products, ideally, if you can buy them grown here in the USA.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this is more of a comment, but first of all, I wanted to thank you for all the research you've done, and I'm here representing four charities, and we are doing a symposium on how to have a healthy baby, how to raise a healthy child, using a lot of your work and research. We have, it's November.
Do you have a question?
Well, I just thought this was furthering their work.
Well, thank you very much. And you have information for that people can pick up afterwards?
I do. Unfortunately, we put this together at the last minute, so I don't really have information. But if anyone is interested in learning more about what he's talking about and hearing lots of internationally known speakers, you could go to sajfem.com or riderfoundation.org. And sorry for making this comment, but I thought it was
kind of important. That's okay. It's birds of a feather. So thank you very much
thank
for your
you.
Support. Yes, sir.
Hi. I'm holding my phone here, not because I'm checking the World Series score, but it's 6-1, if anybody cares. Phillies are up. Anyway, so, my question is about the consumer. How are we going to change consumer behavior to affect this massive change that's required? So currently we're with American Lifestyles, at Earth 5.0, mm-hmm. five Earths in order. We need to get to Earth 1.0. So how do we, lose four Earths worth of consumption? Well, it's interesting if you look back at the history books, and there is a question embedded in this eventually. Adam Smith.
Is the question in the phone also?
The question is the phone is an enabler.
I thought we were supposed to turn those off.
No.
We started. No, I kid because I love. Go ahead. Yes.
Adam Smith, the founder of modern economics, who Alan Greenspan, his testimony to Congress, said was false, and you haven't heard anything from Alan Greenspan since that time.
I think he got his money out of the market just in time,
yeah,
Greenspan.
He cashed out quick.
Yes, go ahead.
So Adam wrote in his previous book, in 1759, The Moral Sentiments of Man, his more favorite book, what he kept working on for the remainder of his life, writes of sympathy and says, "How selfish soever man may be supposed, there are evidently some principles in his nature which interest him in the fortune of others and render their happiness necessary to him. Though he derives nothing from it except the pleasure of seeing it." So when we talk about the new citizen consumer who has all the power, how do you and us and everybody here get us back to a sympathetic note so we become a citizen consumer again?
You know, I don't know what it is that inspires or sparks people to do something, but my observation has been in recent years that a connection to their health is critical. There are lots of things that inspire people. And to take nothing away from the important campaign to deal with climate change and all the implications for consumption and purchasing patterns and consumer behavior that are underneath that huge pressing problem. When people understand that they're being exposed to something that may affect the health, maybe not of them, but of a loved one, particularly someone who's vulnerable, a child, that spurs action. We have seen tremendous reaction to our work, I'm proud to say, precisely because people are coming to it, in many cases, out of a concern that something just seems wrong. All this breast cancer, all this asthma, all of this autism, something just doesn't feel right to people. And they don't necessarily feel that we have to understand exactly what exposures of exactly what chemicals are causing it and prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt. They're basically starting with a common sense proposition that if there's reason to believe that something is harmful, maybe we should start figuring out a smarter way to live our lives without requiring these toxic exposures. So my answer to you would be, at least for this evening, take away the lesson about health and people's profound either self-interest or familial or friendship interest in someone who's experiencing a health problem, and make it your business to ask yourself the fundamental question, which parents of children with autism who inspire me almost as much as anyone else in this community ask. Is there anything I can do to prevent from happening to another child what has happened to mine? And I believe that would be the sentiment that you just read, sir. Thank you. Yes, ma'am. Do we have more time? Carol, one more question. One more question and four more people. Should we go with the biggest person or... I'll stay after. And you're not the biggest person. I didn't mean that. Go for it.
Maybe you have to go to the gym more. So I have a two-part question regarding the organic industry.
Okay. All right.
So the first one is the regulation of organic farmers. It's my understanding that once a farm is registered as USDA organic, that there's very little follow-up to that farm, and that the rumors are abound that once they're certified organic, that many actually revert back to conventional use of pesticides. So what are we doing in terms of regulating the organic industry?
Well, the regulatory system for organic agriculture in this country is, in order to be certified organic and have that USDA organic seal, you have to be certified, and it's always through a third party, a certifying agency that is responsible for site visits to the farm, which should be annual. Then USDA in that program and others also with respect to pesticides tests organic food for pesticides. I don't think there's any question that there's room for moral hazard, as they say, in the insurance industry. So someone might be tempted to cheat, and my guess would be that it could be a farmer who might be tempted, but even perhaps more so a middleman who might fill up that bushel of organic apples that's a little light with some conventional ones. It's a possibility. There haven't been a lot of examples of fraud, although there was a very disturbing one this year, not an organic farmer and not an organic retailer or wholesaler, but a fertilizer company here in California selling as organic fertilizer that clearly wasn't. And the regulators, as the Sacramento Bee, I believe, uncovered, were sound asleep at the watching this thing. So I think what we have to hope for is that as this industry matures, there will be even closer scrutiny of it. My feeling from knowing hundreds of organic farmers is that they are very committed to making sure that on their farm they follow these practices that are specified rigorously. So I have a lot of faith in them, but they have to follow all the organic rules and all the other rules that apply to conventional farmers on top of it. So it's a pretty big burden, and there's no predicting where there might not be someone who breaks the rules, but my feeling is that the organic industry in this country does a pretty good job.
That sort of leads me to my next question. In the last farm bill, no incentives toward organic farmers whatsoever. So what are we doing from toward Congress to incent them for the next round of farm bills that are going to be coming up to ensure that the millions of dollars that we give to the large industrial farmers actually go to promoting smaller, increased number of organic farmers?
That's a very good question. There was some progress made, but not enough to suit us in the last in the farm legislation that Congress passes every 4 or 5 years that authorizes our subsidy programs and the food stamp program and lots more beyond. And a number of us had fought to have organic agriculture receive more research funds and receive some funding to help farmers convert from conventional to organic, and for organic farmers who are out there doing a good job, give them just a fraction of the money that we provide to the subsidized farmers. But here's a fact that we made during the debate that had some effect, but not as much as we wanted. There was one cotton farm in 2005 that received the same amount of money from the federal government as the main research program for all of organic agriculture at the federal level in the country, $2.5 million. One cotton farm got that much, and all of organic agriculture received that much for research support. So needless to say, we have a disparity there that we need to do something about if we want to grow this industry, and we do, in a way that respects the rules, is rigorous, is carefully monitored, but sees that sector expand so that we can look back 10 years from now and recognize that organic is not just private school for food. It's much more available, much more affordable, and is supporting many more family farmers across the country.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
We'd like to thank Ken for leading this informative discussion. I learned just recently that he's leading Environmental Working Group, is leading the polls in the Huffington Post, ultra-effective environmental organization. So check that out and vote if you're so inspired. We would like to thank our audiences here as well as our radio audience, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating more than 100 years of enlightened discussion is adjourned.